You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, everybody, don't forget, we've got a webinar this Wednesday, June 15th at 7 p.m. called Enhance This, where I'm going to explain regional theater deals and how they work into developing new shows on their way to Broadway or off-Broadway and everywhere in between. This Wednesday, June 15th, check out theproducersperspective.com for more details, including how you can take it for free.
I wanna be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I wanna be a producer.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hi, everybody. Ken Davenport here. So I'm going to make this introduction super short so we can get to this titan of a guest we have today. Ladies and gentlemen, please stand as I welcome to the microphone the winner of the Tony Award for Lifetime Achievement, Mr. Paul Libin. Welcome, Paul.
Oh, good afternoon, Ken.
Mr. Libin,
I'm going to quit right now. I'm way ahead.
Oh, no, you've got a lot more to do. Mr. Libin is the executive director of the Jamison Theaters. He has produced over 250 Broadway and off-Broadway shows in his over 50 years of service to our industry. In those 50 years, he's been an actor, he's been a director, stage manager, and much, much more. He was the president of the League of Off-Broadway Theaters and Producers. He was the chairman of the Broadway League. He is the president, a.k.a. the theater owner, of Circle in the Square Theater. He has seen it all, and he has the stories to prove it. So, Paul, let's get to it. What was your very first job in the theater?
My very first job in the theater, I was a gopher for Joe Melzina. I had just graduated Columbia School of the Dramatic Arts. I'd come back and finished my last year on the GI Bill in 1950 and 51, when the semester ended. That's when I came to New York. It was 1956 when I came back and finished up Columbia on the GI Bill. I had started as an actor, had three seasons of summer stock, and got drafted at the tail end of the Korean War. And while I was in the Army, I started a theater group, which gave me an opportunity to direct and design and produce. And the taste of that was so rich and rewarding, I decided I had to be involved in production. So when I finished my last year at Columbia, I had taken a lighting course with a gentleman named Edward Cook, who owned a company called Century Lighting, which was the premier lighting rental company on Broadway in those days. And I passed my test with an A+, and he said all the room was at the top. So I figured once I graduated, I would contact him and see if he could help me get the kind of work I wanted to get involved in. And I went down to his office, which was wasn't an old warehouse. It was a warehouse on 44th Street or 43rd Street between 10th and 11th, if I remember correctly. And I walked in and I told him that I was looking for work, and he immediately offered me a job. And I kind of mustered up all my strength to say that I didn't want to work in a lighting company. I wanted to be involved in production on Broadway. And he looked at me, and I was very polite in my apology for not taking his offer instantly. And he picked up the phone and called Joe Malzino, who was a good pal of his. He was the premier scenic designer of his day, having designed shows such as Streetcar Named Desire, Death of a Salesman, South Pacific, Mr. Roberts, The King and I. He had it all locked up in terms of that work. And he had a magnificent studio at the famous Dakota Apartments on 72nd Street in Central Park West. And I rushed up there on the subway and walked in and was taken by everything I could see, his sketches on the wall and paintings. And we started to chat. And he asked me a lot of questions about my life. And I asked him a few questions about his life. And we talked for about 45 minutes. And he said, and he clarified that I would have to do whatever had to be done around the office. To me, that meant to go for it. I would get coffee. I'd go get the mail. I'd take the garbage out. Whatever I had to do, deliver a package, a script, pick one up. And he said to me, when would you like to start? And I said, now. And so I started working for him. Right from interview to work. It was like a very special kind of experience because I was so excited. Having been inspired by seeing a production of Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, wanting to be in the theater, wanting to be an actor. Here was a man who designed his set that Elia Kazan directed, and the magic of that set I subsequently learned was so important to the success of the play as I grew older in the business and understood all the components and how they came together in a production. And I remember working for him for a few weeks, and my wife said to me, so what are you getting paid? And I said, you know, I haven't talked about that. So the next morning when I walked in, I said, Mr. Malzino, you know, I got so involved in starting to work here, I want you to know I must be paid, and I want to know what my salary is going to be. And he said, $40 a week. I said, that was great. Being a young, ambitious kid, I kept my eyes and ears open, and he was in the process of actually producing a musical starring Ethel Merman called Happy Hunting. And I was eager to do whatever had to be done, you know, deliver things, pick up things, remove things, fix things, whatever had to be done. And I had a lot of interaction with him about fulfilling whatever task was. And I kept my ears and ears open, and I heard that one of these assistant stage managers was leaving the show, and I told him, enlarging on my past experience that I had been a stage manager in summer stock and all that, which was a bit of a fib, but nonetheless, I knew I could do it. And I became an assistant stage manager at Ethel Merman. It was my first Broadway show. It was 1956. I joined Equity, having not been successful in my Broadway auditions in the prior years before I went into the service. And I started working there. And while I was working there, there were some very talented and creative people involved working in his office at the time. There was Ming Cho Lee, who was an assistant to him, to Mr. Malzino. Pat Ziprod was an assistant to Irene Sheriff, who was going to be the costume designer on the Ethel Merman musical Happy Hunting. And Ward Baker was a production assistant who helped in the casting and everything. And we started talking among ourselves and decided that we wanted to do an off-Broadway play. While we were working for Mr. Malzino and Pat Ziprod working for Irene Sheriff, we undertook to do it, and we raised some money, and we found a theater, and we did it, and it was a big success. It was a revival of Arthur Miller's The Crucible. It was the first revival of the play.
You produced the first revival of The Crucible.
Right, off-Broadway, 1958. And I never looked back after that. was always involved in producing shows, general managing shows. And there was a whole host of shows I got involved in, both producing, general managing. And in 1963, we built a theater to do the Crucible in because we wanted to do it in the round. And years later, Ted Mann was looking for a play to do six characters in search of an author, the Pirandello play. And we had a meeting because he had a show playing at the Circle. And we had a second meeting. And the third meeting, I suggested, well, why don't we just do it together? We shook hands and we did six characters. And that was a partnership that lasted for 50 years at Circle. I became his partner and he became my partner. And we worked together all those years with not a piece of paper between us. We just did it. Show after show, years after years. And I did some other shows outside of that at the same time and then concentrated totally on Circle and Square. And we built a new theater on 50th. Well, we had someone build it for us. And it was a big success when it started. It was not for profit. We used to do four shows a year, and it worked out quite beautifully.
That first show, that revival of The Crucible, what made you think that you could produce it? What gave you the courage to do something like that? How old?
I was 27 by the time we did it. At 58, I would be 27. What prompted me about the play was I was always tuned into what was going around in the world and current events. When the original play was done on Broadway, I was tuned into the play. I was a student at Columbia, and I watched the play from backstage. Somehow, I got an invitation. I don't know how. I can't recall the circumstances. But I remember standing backstage of the Martin Beck Theater, listening to this play, and just being enthralled by it, because when the whole thing with the Roy Cohn and the Red Scare and everything in America, I was actually in Fort Dix, New Jersey, when he came to get his friend out of the Army when the McCarthy hearings, U.S. Army McCarthy hearings were taking place. So I was tuned into that politically, and coming out of a socialist family, I was always aware of everything going on. So I just thought that it was an important play about America at the time. And of course, when we decided to do it, I reached out to Kay Brown, who was then the agent for Arthur Miller at an agency in those days called MCA, Music Corporation of America. And I told her what we were doing the play, and she said, well, we have to talk a little bit more about it. Where are you going to do it? So we were hunting around for a space to rent, and we decided we wanted to do it in the round. And in those days, the only place available to do it in the round would have been Circle in the Square, but Circle in the Square was being produced, shows were being produced by Ted Mann. So we decided we'd try to find our own theater. And I found an empty ballroom in a hotel on 32nd Street in Broadway called the Hotel Martinique. And I went and talked to the owner, and I told him what we wanted to do. And I tried to describe how we wanted to use the space, because it was about 60 by 60 and perfect space for a small 200-seat theater. And I said the stage would be in the middle, and he said to me, you mean like a nightclub? And I said, no, it's not a nightclub, it's a theater. He said, well, we can talk. So I immediately got on the phone and called Kay Brown. I said, we found the theater. And she said, well, Mr. Miller would have to see the theater. And I said, of course. It happened that at that particular moment in life, he was married to Marilyn Monroe. And I made an appointment for him to come see the theater. I was never a devout religious person, but I kept praying. Maybe if he came with Marilyn Monroe and the guy owning the hotel would see Marilyn Monroe, he wouldn't question anything about anything. And that day came, and he arrived with Marilyn Monroe to look at space. And it was pretty overwhelming because I was talking to Arthur Miller when the owner of the hotel walked in, and he saw me and he came right to me. And his wife was off to the side talking to one of my colleagues, and he didn't see her. And then I introduced him to Arthur Miller. I don't know if he knew Arthur Miller at the time, but he's, you know, he was very reasonably polite, but he was a gruff Brooklyn guy. You know, when you shook his, when you shook his hand, you wanted to make sure you had all five fingers on the retreat when you took your hand back. And I said, I'd like you to meet his wife, Miss Marilyn Monroe. And this guy just turned into like, he could hardly speak. He could hardly shake his hand. And, I was very grateful that he happened to come. Well, I called him to come down, but that all that happened in one kind of circuitous event. And so, and then we parted, and I got back in the subway, and of course I told him he could call me at my office, which was not my office, it was Joe Melziner's office. But being a young, ambitious hustler, I used every resource I could to impress whatever I had to do to get things done. And by the time I got back to 72nd Street and Central Park West through the subway system, Mr. Foreman had called me and wanted to know when we were going to sit down and make the deal. And that's when it all started. We built this theater. I'm a very hands-on guy. I still am. And we put it together. And I remember I bought the theater seats were collapsible canvas back seats that I bought. There was a gentleman at the time who had a music tent in Lambertville, New Jersey, and I bought the seats for $1 a piece because we didn't know how long we'd run. So we spent $200 for the seats because they were all from his summer theater event, and the show opened. It was a big success. It was directed by Word Baker. It had Barbara Barry played Goody Proctor. An actor named Michael Higgins played John Proctor. It was a challenge because as we were moving closer to get to opening, I mustered the courage up to call and speak to Arthur, telling him that I want him to be there, but I don't want him to be there on opening night because I think he came with his wife on opening night. The audience would have a rough time watching the show because she was such a stellar attraction in those days. So I said, no, we understand. We'll come by some other night and kind of slip in at the last moment and take our seats. So it was a big hullabaloo that night, on opening night. There were a lot of people. There was a big crowd expecting to see Marilyn Monroe, and she didn't come up, and I was trying to quiet them down. I got in a scuffle with some young people who wanted to see her, and the police came and they broke it up. And later someone said to me, oh, Paul, you have a cut. Your jacket is all ripped in the back. And I took my jacket off and realized I was actually cut. And I had my shirt with small blood stain on my shirt. And realized someone had gotten a little rambunctious. And I'll never forget the press agent was an old timer, and there was a reporter there from the New York Post who wanted to interview me, and I wasn't cooperative. And Saul Jacobson was his name. He came over to me and he said, Paul, he puts his arm around me, they're going to write a story, whether you cooperate or not, so you might as well just cooperate. And they're asking you questions, answer the questions as best you can. And so they start talking to me, and then he asked me where I lived, and all that. I'm not going to tell him where I lived. So I made up an address that I lived on Park Avenue.
See, listeners, I promised you he had the stories, and he does. Marilyn Monroe, he gets cut on opening night, and he's lying about where he lives. A good producer, for sure. So one of the, over the past 50, 60 years of your career, you've been very active in labor negotiations.
Right.
And you've seen a lot of changes, I'm sure. We're involved with them right now, both of us.
Right.
What's the biggest change you've seen in how the negotiations with the union from the early days of organization to now?
Well, it's everything has gotten, through the years, as these contracts have gotten developed, they've become more codified, very specifically about all kinds of different tasks and making certain people get paid for certain tasks. I recall the earlier days, things were more general, they weren't as carefully defined in terms of task. And I suppose through the years, assignment of tasks related to cost and expense is what developed to make the contracts much more complex in terms of their jurisdiction and the work that gets done. And I think that all came as a result of my early career was always off-Broadway, but I had already, shortly after I started my partnership with Ted Mann in the 60s, I was involved in Broadway and off-Broadway. Off-Broadway from 1950s, in the 50s, mid-50s, for 30 years off-Broadway, I was also involved in Broadway at the same time. And I think the codification of assignment and expense and the duties that people have in the variety of contracts, not just stagehands, but everything, directors, scenic designers, wardrobe people, as the business has gotten more complex and more technologically evolving in terms of accomplishing the magic of the theater, there's been a particular attention to how people get paid. And that compartmentalization of expense has pushed the cost up dramatically from what it was. Aside from the fact that, you know, obviously what people were paid in the 1950s is a lot different than they're paid now, but all reinforced by assignment. Same thing with musicians, you know. There were more musicians working on Broadway, getting less money. Now, with the doubling of instruments and technology, reproduction and sound and whatever enhancements have come, people have gotten paid more. And I think that's the dramatic change in that application of that circumstance.
And do you think that will just continue? Will we continue to compartmentalize more?
It seems to me there has to be a line somewhere where we almost have to start over. It's just the expenses have gotten so complex and so costly, and aside from being complex, that it seems to me that the price of tickets just can't keep going up. I mean, if we have to only rely on 1% of the people who have the money to come to the theater will die. And the economics of admission into the theater is a very important consideration. Although I don't know the numbers, but it seems like for the theaters that we have remaining, I mean, years ago there were more theaters, but now, you know, the number runs about between 40 and 50 theaters in the Broadway world, they seem to be full and people keep coming and the prices go from very little to very high. You know, it's that landscape of pricing is very complex. And then I know many people complain about it all the time, but at the same time, every night there are seats available at very low prices for people to come see the theater if they're attracted to something they want to see. And I think the taste of theater goers has changed dramatically.
What way?
Well, I think there's a lure for a form of entertainment as contrast to enlightenment of experience and dramatic experience. Years ago, there were so many plays that were being done on Broadway. There are much fewer plays done every year on Broadway, simply because I think technology through the television and through other methods of electronic viewing of content, we now see things more easily than we did years ago. The format of them and the sophistication of the creative aspects of serious plays or subject matters that are of interest to the viewers is available in so many different forms that that has satisfied an appetite for people. The ability to watch on television, now if you're intrigued by a particular show or a series, you can watch the whole thing, you know, you can just pig out on it and sit there for a weekend and just watch all 20 episodes. Or you can watch them when you have time to watch them as opposed to having to be someplace. And I think that there's a refuge that the theater has become for people, certainly through the last economic downturn that we had in the U.S. economy. I remember talking to people. I remember once having a luncheon with some bankers who were always looking for your business, where they said, well, we've heard that your business has done very well while our business has collapsed. And I said, it has. And they said, can you explain it? I said, if I could explain it, I'd be a businessman. Although I always felt that people, during that period, people came to the theater to get away from it because the news was so overwhelming. I mean, that's all you heard about, this business collapsing, that business collapsing, the market collapsing, don't have money to do this, you can't send the kids to college, the mortgages have collapsed, your home is being taken away from you. And this was a place to sit in a room with some other people and laugh and be entertained, which was a refuge from the crises of the day. Or that year, actually it was a couple of years, it wasn't just 1 year. But there's something about the experience that an audience has when they come and see something that is enlightening if the subject matter is profound or if it's entertaining, that just provides this unique appetite for people have to get away from the box. When I refer to the box, I'm talking about television or the movie theater, and see something live. There's something magical about live when it's working that's overwhelming. It's totally overwhelming. I remember a couple of years ago I went to see Nathan Lane in Chicago for Iceman Comet. And it was a Saturday night in Chicago at the Goodman Theater, and it sold out, standing room only. And I thought, well, knowing the play real well, there are going to be some people to check out. You know, they're just not going to stay the whole time. They were just spellbound. They could not leave. I don't know if they wanted to leave, but they did not leave. You know, that they were just spellbound by the experience of Nathan and Brian Dennehy and the other group of actors doing this masterful piece of writing. So there is a magic to it that's inexplicable for some reason when it works.
Is there anything that you see today that's happened on Broadway, something that's changed, that if you think back, you would think, that'll never happen. This will never happen. And then it has. Anything that has surprised you about the changes that Broadway's undergone over the last 50 years?
Well, I think the one most important thing that's happened on Broadway over the last 50 years is when people come to attend the production, the old days of the curtain coming down and two intermissions, now that total experience of immersing themselves in this magical world that we call the theater is that things have to keep moving all the time. They can't stop. You can't take the curtain down and have a minute and a half scenic change. A minute and a half is a disaster. You know, you can have a break between the one act and the second act. You run into trouble when you have two breaks, an hour in between each. It's clear that it's harder for people to sit for 3 hours than it's easier for them to sit for 2 hours. Certain dramatic material that's presented in 90 minutes or 120 minutes seems to be more effective and because people have learned to absorb things at a higher speed than they did years ago. Years ago, everything was done with two intermissions. And it started late at night, 8:30, 8 o'clock. I mean, those 8:30 was the traditional curtain time on Broadway in the old days. And then it moved to 8. Now it's 7. You know, so there's too many things people have to do in their lives now. Either to work harder or to spend more time with their family or more time away from their family, whatever the case may be. But they can enjoy something in 2 hours only because of the speed of information is absorbed. Audiences have learned to watch something and figure out the roadmap of how it's going to happen. And of course, every once in a while, when you give them a twist and turn, they're pretty overwhelmed by that. Most people are intrigued by the magic of a dramatic development and that what they watch, whether it's in an entertainment or a serious play.
What's the, besides yourself, who's the greatest producer you've seen or the greatest piece of producing you've seen if it was on a specific show? Something that you've sat back and be like, look at that guy. That's some producing right there.
Well, it's funny. As you know, last year, I made a booking for Fun Home at the Circle in the Square. And, of course, shortly thereafter, Hamilton opened. And it opened off-Broadway to great acclaim. And I thought, oh, well, I thought I picked the winner. Maybe I didn't pick a winner. And certainly if they were competing, based on the fact that one was a bigger scale musical and the other one was more family, different storyline, a conflict in a family, the human condition, a more intimate story. I thought, well, my secret wish was that Hamilton wouldn't open in the season that I did the play. And of course, there was a lot of talk about they would move up to Broadway and they'd open on Broadway. And I think every night I would do my Nirvana and say, you know, Novena, forgive me, and beg that they wouldn't open. And of course, they didn't open. And Fun Home won the Tony Award for the Best Musical, which was a stretch to begin with, and a remarkable achievement, actually, with all the competition that was available. And then my wife and I went to see the opening, Florence and I went to see the opening of Hamilton. And the first number I thought was just spectacular. The second number was spectacular. I mean, I just was having such a good time. And the third number, I was just all caught up in it, and my wife leaned over, Florence leaned over and grabbed my forearm. She says, calm down, it's not your show. So it was, you know, kind of a wonderful, it's a magical piece of producing and theater. And the other thing that's so extraordinary about it, it's very simple. I mean, the content is complex, but the whole undertaking of how it was conceived and presented is so magical. You know, it's the essence of what the theater is about. And, you know, every once in a life, you know, there's a couple of things in my life that are, you know, just unique experiences. The first one, of course, was I went to see Death of a Salesman as a young man. I had no interest in the theater. I mean, I hadn't even gone to the theater much as a young man. I was already in college, and I went to see Death of a Salesman with Thomas Mitchell playing Willie Loman, and I was absolutely overwhelmed. And while my friend, I was on a double date with another couple, he went to get his father's borrowed car, and I was standing in front of the Erlanger Theater in Chicago, and Thomas Mitchell walked out with his collar up and the brim of his hat pulled down, and I looked at him, and I said, oh my God, Willie Loman is alive! I was just blown away by that. And I said, that's my destiny. That's something I have to do that. And I remember coming home to my parents and telling my dad that I found my destiny. My dad said to me, so what's your destiny? And I told him I have to be an actor. And he said, well, he says, you know, 2 months ago, you with a couple of friends, you bought a sailboat that you're fixing up. You want to sail it down to Chicago, you know, the river, and into the Caribbean, and then sell the boat, and then come back to go to school. And before that, you want to go to the University of Chicago to study international studies. He said, decide what you're going to do and just go do it. I said, that's what I got to do. Ironically, the first part I played was in Arthur Miller's All My Sons. So I have a long history of Arthur Miller. So, you know, when I saw that production and had the great privilege and honor to do the first revival in New York of Death of a Salesman with George Scott, 25 years after the original Broadway opening, that was a thrilling moment in my life, or I should say evening. 50 years later, I did it again with Brian Dennehy, and that was a great production, as George's was. And Brian Dennehy gave me a shout-out on when he got his Tony Award, the rich moment in my life when you get a thank you from a great actor. Angels in America was one of the things I'm most proud about being involved in producing.
I would take just one of those, by the way, just yeah. one.
Yeah, I always say you get them once in your lifetime. I've had a couple of great ones in my lifetime.
Well, speaking of your lifetime, I mean, what do you credit your success at being able to survive and thrive in this business, which will admittedly beat you up every single day? But you've not just had one big success. You've had many. You're still here. You're still doing it. And obviously, as I'm sure everyone can hear, you still love it. How do you do that?
I do love it. There's something I just thrive on being able to be a part of assisting in the realization of a project. It's, to me, is just thrilling. And the other thing that makes it work for me is you're always working with new people and different people, different ideas. Different ways of articulating them. I've worked with the biggest names in this business, and it's been one of the great rich rewards seeing them, you know, do what they do and how they do it. And, you know, I had some confrontations with people, but they're motivated to do the best, and I'm motivated to do the best, and ultimately that's it. And every once in a while, you run against them. Personality that's difficult, but if you use your smarts, you work that out, figure a way out to handle that, because it's you know, sometimes creative people are complex, insecure people, and they, you know, they swing back. And you have to learn how to modulate that. Sometimes you have to swing back, and so that's life. You swing back, you take a punch and get one back if you have to. But and I've done that in my life too. But it's just it's so interesting. One of my ambitions was to have a Broadway theater, and I think 6 years after I had the Circle in the Square, I remember walking west on 50th Street, looking at the marquee, and I said, you know. I wanted this, and I've had it for 6 years, and I didn't even fully realize I've had it for 6 years, working on things, having confrontations with labor negotiations and settling them, because we're all in it together, and it's a wonderful collaboration of so many talented people. It's just fun. It's just I'll be 86 this year, and I just feel like a kid still. I don't know how to explain it. It's just a joy.
What do you think the business will look like in another 25, another 50 years?
Well, one of the things I always have embraced, well, I shouldn't say always, because you have to have a certain perspective when you look back at the theater. I didn't have that perspective when I started as a young man. But I have it now. Occasionally people will come to me and they'll say to me, you know, Paul, Broadway is not like it used to be. And I always have to say to them, don't you understand that Broadway's never been how it used to be? That's why it's still here. That's why it's exciting. That's why it changes. Everything in life changes. It can't be like it is. It just can't. It always changing, because the whole idea is this creative force of, you get directors, you get writers, you get actors who come up with new ideas of how to do plays. So I remember I was interviewed when Seymour Hoffman did Death of a Salesman. A reporter called me and said, you know, I've read about it, but I know that you're a great fan of Death of a Salesman. So which is your favorite? I said, well, let me tell you. And I started off with Thomas Mitchell. And after Thomas Mitchell, I said, I saw Lee J. Cobb do it on TV. I was not in New York then. And then I saw Dustin Hoffman do it, and then George Scott do it. And they were great, you know. And then I went, Brian Denny do it, and then Mr. Hoffman do it. And the reporter says to me, so which one would you think is the greatest? I said, I just told you. So they were all great. That's what's so magical about the theater. That you can take a great piece of writing and just lay it out in front and put it in the hands of a great actor, and it's an exciting, thrilling moment. And I remember Arthur Miller told me that when I got to spend a little time with him, not a lot, but a little time with him when we did The Crucible, and I remember him sharing with me the story that when he visited China, one of the literary important accomplished writers of Chinese literature at the time was talking to Arthur, and he said to Arthur, how did you understand the Chinese family so well that you could write a play like that for Salesman?
I'd love to know what he said to that.
Yeah. Anything in your career you would do differently if you were doing it all over again? Any regrets? Anything that you say, I wish I would have just done this?
Well, there's nothing, you know, I'm not going to list. It's just an exciting experience to go see a play that you're not involved in that just catches you up and takes you on a journey. That's, to me, a lot of fun.
Okay, my last question, which is my genie question. I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin comes to your office here, Jujamson, knocks on the door, and says, Paul, I want to thank you for your incredible contributions to the theater for the last 50, 60 years. And I want to thank you by granting you one wish, just one. What's the one thing that makes you so angry about Broadway, that gets you frustrated, keeps you up at night, would get you pounding? I've heard you yell a couple times myself at me, which is not very pleasant, by the way. What would make you so mad, that gets you so angry, that you would ask this genie to wish away?
Well, I think it's a crime that every night on Broadway, there are thousands of seats that are not occupied by people seeing something. I think that if we could solve that problem, that would be just great. I mean, obviously the hits are always at capacity, but there's so many other wonderful experiences. And I think for some reason there are too many people in our culture, I don't know if culture is the right word, there are too many people near the theater, physically near the theater, who would be so rewarded by the experience, even if the production that they witnessed was not the most perfect or accomplished ones compared to the ones that are the ones that shine brighter than others. That experience of being in a room with other people and laughing or crying, depending on what they were seeing, that would be a beautiful wish to be fulfilled.
Well, I am no genie, but I don't have any wishes to give you, but I certainly want to thank you for sitting down with us today and for your incredible contribution to the business. You know, we forget that Broadway is still a young industry, and the people like you who helped build it are still here today, still doing it, and we appreciate that so very much. So thank you for that. Thanks to all of you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe. Until the next episode, I'm Ken Davenport. This has been the Producer's Perspective Podcast.
Don't forget the webinar this Wednesday, June 15th at 7 p.m., all about enhancement deals for regional theaters. And you can take it free when you join the Producers Perspective Pro. Check it out on the blog.
I'm gonna be a producer. Look out, Broadway, here I come.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.